Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program, is South Africa's jobs crisis far bigger than policymakers will admit? A global backlash against captive lion breeding puts South African tourism's reputation at risk. Tongaat and Murrayan Roberts expose hard truths about boardroom failure. And work is faster than ever and burnout is rising across South African workplaces. It's Wednesday, the 18th of March. Now, there's an argument that South Africa's unemployment crisis is being fundamentally misunderstood, with current policy debates focusing on marginal job creation targets while ignoring the sheer scale and structural nature of the problem. It continues that even ambitious pledges like creating millions of jobs over a decade fall far short of what is needed in an economy where unemployment is deeply entrenched, inequality is widening, and economic policy may itself be part of the problem. Neil Coleman is Senior Policy Specialist at the Institute for Economic Justice. Neil, welcome, and you argue that the current jobs debate is simply missing the point. What is it getting fundamentally wrong then?
Yeah, Jeremy, thanks very much. My colleague Duma Kubule argues that, you know, we need to treat this current unemployment crisis as something requiring something like a war effort. You know, if we think back to the post-war effort in Europe or the New Deal in the US, it needs a sort of all of society effort to mobilize all available resources, address the unemployment crisis. And, you know, I always say that there are three elements to dealing with the economic challenges. One is to stabilize the society, the businesses, the communities, and so on, facing a range of challenges. Just think of, you know, job losses, think of communities in depression, and so on. The second is to stimulate investment, to stimulate employment. And the third is to structurally transform. Now, all we're doing at the moment is that we're focusing on stabilizing an element of the society which services business, namely the question of getting electricity right, rail right, you know, basic what are called network industry. This is what's called the structural reforms. And the reality is, even if you look at Treasury's own projections, this creates a tiny, tiny proportion of the jobs that are required, because our economy is structured in a particular way that it's unable to absorb the huge numbers of people who are currently outside the mainstream economy. So that requires structural transformation. What we're talking about here is that, you know, we have an economy that has a semi-colonial character. It's a legacy of a minerals exporting country, largely, in which the industrialization that we did have has rapidly sort of disappeared with the adoption of what are called liberalization measures. So in critical industries like the textile industry and clothing, for example, you know, are massively hit by the removal of tariffs. So we've actually gone in the opposite direction of what we need to do. And if you look at the developmental state interventions that have taken place over the last century, you know, whether in the Asian Tigers, China now, and a number of other societies, those relied on the state to play a very leading role. And what we're doing in South Africa is we see a state which is stepping back and relying on the private sector to deliver. Both the state and the private sector are disinvesting from the economy. Instead of the massive investment that we need to see, we're actually seeing a hoarding of cash by the private sector and the state, and not investing on anything like the scale that is needed. So the question is, what is the paradigm and what are the parameters that need to shift in order to stimulate this new type of economic intervention.
Neil, that's a very worrying statement because if I'm hearing you correctly, you're suggesting that the state is simply abrogating its responsibility to the private sector in many respects. Has government just given up then?
I think there's an element of capture. We had state capture by predatory interests in society in the Zuma period. And we now have got another element, type of capture where corporations, you know, in the state in a very weak position are pushing an agenda which is very narrow. It's not about the state only abrogating its responsibility, it's about the economic elites and corporations abrogating their responsibilities. I mean, we're seeing massive job losses taking place. As I said, there is a massive investment. Well, there's an investment strike in which you see massive resources sitting idle in the financial sector. So it's, as I said, it's about an all of society initiative. And, you know, we have to pull in, we have to mobilize these resources, which are not just about material resources, but also about human resources, which are being massively wasted in South Africa, and start thinking of things completely differently. When we talk about, like, this conference that's coming up at the end of this week, talk about 5 million jobs over the next 10 years, people are impressed by that because that sounds like, you know, quite bold. Mm. But actually, when you look at the figures, and Duma has calculated these figures, you end up with an unemployment rate of over 40% in 2035, you know, with those additional 5 million jobs. And it's just, you know, it's frightening about the extent of denialism that is you know, pervasive in society at the moment. When we saw the claim by Capitec CEO that unemployment was not really the challenge that is claimed, he said it's below 10%. I mean, it goes against all the evidence, repeated studies by Stats SA. They've even tweaked the definitions and so on, come up repeatedly with the same results. We've got to confront the reality that over 12 million people in this country are unemployed, and that the vast bulk of those, we estimate over 10 million, are long-term unemployed. They have not had a job for well over a year. And millions of those are now what is called discouraged. They have given up looking for work. So there needs to be a complete rejigging of our thinking on these economic challenges.
So if we're to do that, then if you're to rejig the thinking, what role should the state realistically be playing then in large scale, short to medium term job creation?
Well, I think, you know, in the article, we refer to the policy tools that the state has at its disposal. And the sort of biggest tools that it has are its fiscal policy, the monetary policy, and its trade and industrial policy. So it's about deploying those in an aggressive manner to crowd in investment, which means both the state to introduce a fiscal stimulus, to promote economic activity in depressed communities, to create the demand that business needs to expand. But we also need to bring down the cost of capital. We need to bring down the cost of investment, of borrowing, and so on, which is much too high because of these narrow contractionary monetary and fiscal policies that we've adopted. So it requires a completely different mindset. And then in terms of industrial and trade policies, those need to be very well resourced, strategic. We need to look at the changing international environment and look at how do we make South Africa and the Southern African region more an engine of growth in the continent. So it is a huge challenge, you know, particularly given with the crisis that we are now is now looming. Yeah.
And that, Neil Coleman, is difficult to do. You've got to find that balance because the conventional wisdom, or the prevailing conventional wisdom these days, seems to be one of austerity.
Yes, exactly. And you know, there's an old saying that you keep on doing the same thing, expecting a different result, is the definition of insanity. And that's basically what we've been doing. I mean, last year there was a moderate improvement in the budget, very, very moderate. But now we've pulled back again into the austerity, into the austerity mode. And we seem to be more worried about, you know, impressing the multilateral IMF, World Bank, etc. Type institutions and the ratings agencies. But actually, we must remember the ratings agencies are not only concerned with fiscal stability, they're also saying the unemployment crisis and poverty in South Africa is unsustainable. So retreating back into that mode is completely self-defeating. And not only will we not achieve this 5 million jobs over the next 10 years, we will, you know, we will see growing unemployment and job loss in the country. So at what point do people say, look, this is a crisis that needs a complete shift in our mindset? That is a critical question.
Neil Coleman, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's wildlife tourism reputation, I read, is facing fresh scrutiny after a new international poll has found that around 70% of international tourists would be put off visiting a country that allows captive lion breeding for profit. Around 69% said reversing the phase out would damage South Africa's reputation as an ethical destination. The poll goes on to warn that if major source markets turn away, the country could lose an estimated 860,000 visitors and put around 66,000 jobs at risk. Those are big numbers. Let's discuss this in a little more detail. Dr. Stephanie Klarman is with me, campaign coordinator at the organization Blood Lions. Stephanie, a very warm welcome to you. How serious then is this reputational risk to our tourism brand?
Well, we have to take these kinds of numbers seriously. I mean, as you said, if we extrapolate, we're looking at 160,000 tourists from our four key source markets, being the UK, US, Germany, and the Netherlands, being deterred. So this is incredibly big if we also compare that to the commercial captive lion industry. Now, there we have approximately 350 facilities across the country, mostly concentrated in the Free States, Northwest, and Limpopo. And they only employ somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 people, according to the ministerial task team. So you can see that there's an enormous difference between these two sectors. We have one very, very concentrated and small commercial sector, and then we have another which really impacts the entire country, not only our reputation, but we're talking about tens of thousands of jobs as well.
What I find odd is that government has not yet moved decisively, given that the phase out was committed to, if memory serves, 2020, 2021.
That is correct, yes. Former ministers Barbara Creasy and Dion George had already committed to phasing out this industry. But with the inclusion now of Willem Oukamp, he has remained quiet up to this point, and we've had no definitive stance. And what's really surprising to us is that the DA themselves included a commitment to ending this industry in their own party's resolution. And so it's been very strange to not see any definitive stance or action taken since November last year.
Probably an unfair question, but I am going to ask you to speculate on the inertia here. Why do you think there's been nothing done?
It's a difficult one. You know, we do know that Minister Oukamp does have some connections, at least within the wildlife industry, with, you know, regards to family having an interest in wildlife breeding and hunting. So he is potentially a proponent of the commercial industry. We're not necessarily saying only for lions, but the industry as a whole, there are some potential connections there. And so if we speculate, you know, that is potentially based on those connections.
So what I'm hearing you say is that we simply don't at this point have the political will to finish the process. We are essentially stalling under pressure from vested interests.
Correct. I would say that this is a matter of political will.
So how do you accelerate change if you can do it at all?
Well, we really are hoping that by looking at these numbers and knowing that it's not only a matter of the Department of Environment, but also that this could affect other sectors in South Africa, we really need to start looking at how widespread this problem is. You know, it's not just animal welfare, for example. We're also looking at our tourism sector, and our tourism sector is enormous. I mean, if we take a look, our tourism sector contributes up to 9% of our GDP, and that exceeds transport, mining, and agriculture. So we cannot ignore that this has implications beyond just environmental matters or animal welfare.
Stephanie, what do you think this poll tells us about how international tourists now see South Africa in 2026?
It's a very good question, and I think that this is simply a continuation of what we've been seeing for the last 15 or so years. I mean, if we look at Blood Lions was released in 2015, and already then there was enormous public opposition. We know that airlines started banning transporting trophy hunting of captive bred lions. We know, for example, that countries were looking at banning the import of those trophies. And so there has been ongoing and widespread opposition, and we need to understand that this could have serious implications.
This might sound like an odd question, but let's assume that there is positive move, Stephanie, in resolving the issue. What would happen in practical terms to the thousands of lions already in captivity?
So this has been dealt with in the ministerial task team, and it's a very, very important process. So we have around 8,000 or so lions in captivity. And again, I just want to stress that these are purely there for their commercial value. So if this industry is phased out responsibly, what we would see first and foremost is a ban on the breeding of lions to start with. Then lion breeders will most likely want to trade out their existing lions, in which case a number of these animals would already be part of this industry, and that would slowly decrease their numbers. There's also a number of lions that could potentially be rehomed to true sanctuaries, but South Africa really doesn't have much capacity in our existing genuine sanctuaries. And then we also need to note that captive bred lions will not be rewilded. There is no conservation need to use these lions for in situ conservation. And so really what we're seeing is a slow process of phasing it out. But first and foremost, we need to stop breeding so that we're not adding to the current population of captive lions.
And if this doesn't happen, I think what I'm hearing you say is that this is now a defining test of whether this country wants to be seen as a serious, ethical wildlife destination or not.
I completely agree with you, and we need to remember that South Africa is one of the premier tourism destinations for wildlife viewing and safaris. We really cannot afford a tarnished reputation.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Stephanie Klarman, campaign coordinator at Bloodlines.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, two of South Africa's best-known corporates, and you'll be well aware of this, Sir Tongaat Hulett and Marian Roberts, have become real case studies in prolonged distress, business rescue, and boardroom failure. And I think that raises tough questions, hard questions about how long directors wait before acting and whether boards are properly reading the warning signs. Tongaat, if memory serves, entered business rescue in late 2022, and Marian Roberts formally commenced proceedings in November 2024. And that underscored how widespread and prolonged corporate stress has become. I want to discuss this in a little more detail with Eric Levenstein, who's head of insolvency and business rescue at Worksmans. Eric, a very warm welcome to you. What do Tongaat and Marian Roberts tell us about how boards respond to distress in this country?
I think, Jeremy, the fundamental is that most boards in South Africa wait far too long before they get into the understanding of what's going wrong with their business. So when a company hits a period of constraint, maybe not even financial distress, it would be at that point in time along that distress curve where they need to get in professionals to look at the possibility of a turnaround, whether it be informal or maybe even go down the business rescue route. The problem in South Africa is most directors wait far too long before they engage and, in fact, recognize that the company is in trouble. And I think that's really the lesson to be learned from a Marian Roberts and a Tongaat Hulett.
Why do directors wait too long? Is it inertia? Is it fear? What is it?
I think the biggest issue, Jeremy, is the loss of control. If they are looking at handing over the reins to a business rescue practitioner, particularly if the company's been in the hands of, let's say, a family, there might be emotional ties historically, and no one wants to really put up their hand to say, you know, we need help. Maybe things haven't gone as well as we thought they would have. And therefore, the loss of control, I think, is the biggest issue. Of course, if you continue as a director to trade a company in insolvent circumstances, that could be deemed to be reckless and could, in fact, open up directors and management to personal claims from creditors. So all of these things are in the mix. I just don't think directors really understand the mechanisms of the Companies Act, in particular Chapter 6, which governs business rescue.
You talk about identifying constraint. Are there clear, common red flags that boards miss before a company lands in hot water?
Look, I think most companies face changes in market conditions. There might be an exchange rate issue. There might be an inability to import raw materials. What's going on at the moment with oil prices, etc. It could be very much an external knock-on effect for the company's ability to trade. And then, of course, internally, some directors might not be running the company properly. They don't see the writing on the wall. Creditors start to get aggressive. They're not being paid in terms of the ordinary terms of being paid. And at the end of the day, the more aggressive the creditors become, the more they push the company towards either liquidation or at least the consideration of an option like business rescue. So I think the warning signals are pretty obvious. Inability to pay your creditors, your banks are putting you under pressure, and of course your suppliers are not being paid on time. So once that's in the mix, I think professional assistance is required.
And Eric, there's also a lot of emotion attached to this whole process, I would imagine. And it's difficult, surely, for directors to balance loyalty to management on the one hand with a legal duty, as you've indicated, to confront deterioration in an organization early.
Exactly. And, as I said earlier, it's a question of education. How do you get directors to understand what their duties and obligations are about? We write about this as lawyers all the time in the mainstream media. It's just very difficult, Jeremy, to get directors of distressed companies into a seminar. I don't think there'll be a long queue for directors to join us. So that really is an issue. But I think the more we speak about it, like in a forum today, it's very important that directors embrace the obligations and duties set out very clearly, in fact, in the Companies Act. And in particular, the interests of the company is paramount. It's about the stakeholders, the creditors, the employees, the trade unions, and all stakeholders who are involved in the company need to be considered.
I think sometimes, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that directors don't understand, and I guess it's back to your education observation, they don't understand the kind of risk that they face if they delay action or ignore those obvious warning signs. What can happen to them?
Well, directors need to understand that if they continue to incur credit at a time when they know that credit cannot be repaid. For example, suppliers supplying them with goods, they know they're going to run out of cash pretty quickly. They are trading in a period of financial distress. And the Companies Act talks about personal liability for directors and reckless trading of companies. We haven't seen a proliferation of case law in South Africa where directors have in fact been brought to account. But then again, you have seen the Steinhoffs and the fallout from that whole saga. And I think it's important that creditors, in particular banks in South Africa, if they do see malfeasance on the part of directors, they should be taken to task. And again, you come back to criminal liability or fraud, and it's a question of the NPA and being able to prosecute directors who behave badly.
Do you think, Eric, there are lots of Tongaats and Murray and Roberts volcanoes that are perhaps in danger of erupting?
Very good question. I mean, it is about crystal ball gazing to a degree, Jeremy. But I think with what's going on at the moment, with inflation that's clearly going to be pushed to higher levels, as I said earlier, oil prices, and just a general difficulty in trading companies, I think you are going to see an uptick, probably in the second half of this year as this whole thing starts to unfold. And again, we come back to the same question. Will directors get in early enough to rescue a company that is rescuable? If you get in too late, well, then you really are facing liquidation. And when no one's going to loan additional funding to the company to enable it to trade out of its circumstances and, let's say, into a period of solvent trading.
Do you think that business rescue has become a genuine recovery tool, or do you think that directors just run to it easily and treat it as managed decline?
I think a lot has to do with the skill set of the business rescue practitioners. If they take on a matter, they've got to be able to say to creditors and to the board, look, I think there is a realistic prospect of rescue here. And if they're of the view that it's not the case, they've got to be honest with it, with all the stakeholders, and say, in fact, this company should file for liquidation and not even embrace the business rescue mechanism. And I must say that is in line with international restructuring mechanisms that we see in the USA, Australia, the UK. And I think South Africa's business rescue mechanism brought South Africa into line with those restructuring mechanisms on the international front. So it is a good system. I believe that it's something, if properly done and properly handled by the business rescue practitioner, we will see and continue to see good outcomes.
Eric Levenstein, thank you very much indeed. Head of Insolvency and Business Rescue at Worksmen's Attorneys. Eric, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I don't need to tell you that work these days is faster, it's more connected, it's more technology-driven than ever. Yet many employees feel more depleted than empowered, with stress, constant interruption, blurred boundaries between work and home becoming the new normal. Against the backdrop of Human Rights Day just around the corner, the question is whether modern workplaces are still organized in a way that protects dignity, fair labor practice, and sustainable human performance. I want to put all of that to Ashwin Raja, who is founder of the program Mindset Matters. So, Ashwin, welcome. If technology ostensibly is there to make work better, why does it feel worse for so many people?
Thank you for having me on your show. So, one of the paradoxes we have in the workplace today is exactly as you described. We're building businesses around faster systems, faster processes, improving efficiencies of how we work. But that's not how the human system works, right? Human functioning, human performance works in different rhythms and cycles. And the gap between how humans function and the speed at which technology is moving in opposite directions. And that's where the environment we're working in, as you described, where there's this continuous information flow, continuous communication, expectations of high responsiveness from everyone, creates this exact scenario that you described where people can't keep up at that pace. We're not designed to be continuous operating systems. We work in cycles.
And the problem, I think, is that companies then mistake constant activity, this whirligig, for real meaningful output and productivity.
That's exactly, you've got it on the head there, Jeremy, that people, because we're functioning continuously, doesn't mean we're working at our optimal level of performance. And there's risks in that system. When people are tired, you're making poor decisions, you're not considering all the options, you may be making quicker decisions, not evaluating everything that everyone else is saying in the room to move things forward. And this is how what happens when we are tired and when we are drained. We're working in suboptimal ways from a human functioning. So the challenge that people have to deal with, or organizations have to deal with, is not designing, not changing. Yes, we need to continually improve how business works. That's not going to change. But there's a layer of thinking about how does this impact how we work as people? How do people build businesses where people can function effectively as well and perform effectively? That's where the big gap is. We're building things based on management systems and thinking from the industrial age where we're optimizing machine output. And now when we're in knowledge economy, 70% of our GDP is service-based, and it's highly dependent on people, and this is where the biggest challenge comes in. We're still building systems based on industrial revolution when we've skipped that every two decades or two a century beyond that.
Ashwin, let me try and counterpoint your argument if I can. A lot of the exhaustion that we're talking about is obviously being driven by the way that work is designed, the systems, I understand that. But what about individual weakness? Surely that also does play a role.
100%. There's always friction in a system. And there's a level at which people have to get used to dealing with that drain and that energy and knowing how to reset. So there's definitely a part of the solution is people working in an environment need to adapt and learn how to adapt to work in a continuous environment where you need micro recoveries and to keep going. But we're not built like that. People are not used to working that way. They don't know how to make that adaptation. We haven't studied and done the work on how do humans perform well in the workplace, right? Instead, what the work environment gives you is after the fact, after you're stressed, how do you recover? Which is ideally, that's damage is already done. So how do you build that into the workplace where people are trained and taught how to adapt and optimize how they work effectively? 100%. that's a level where people have to adapt to the environment as well.
But the problem is it's difficult to adapt, or we don't know the way in which we have to do that. I'd suggest that the genie is out the bottle. We have no choice but to change.
100%. The change is inevitable. People need to learn how to adapt more effectively. And part of that is organizations supporting them to adapt more effectively and bringing in more proactive ways around coping, dealing with pressure and levels of stress, as opposed to reactive ways, which are kind of the norm at the moment.
So what are those proactive ways then? What do leaders need to change first if they are serious about sustained performance rather than just short-term output?
So firstly, understanding that humans need to function on cycles, and there's a rhythm of work, peak work, and then recovery. There's a cycle of recovery that we need to understand, right? That cycle goes through, we disrupted in work in many different ways. One, there's cognitive overload. Sometimes there's physical overload, right? The brain consumes 20% of our body's energy. So you get physically drained when you don't have time to reset your actual physical energy. When your brain is, you're not aware that you're not functioning properly, you just keep going. And then there's emotional drain, because there's continuous friction and conflict and disagreements happening in organizations. So how do people learn to reset each of these elements? Just take those three elements. How do I reset cognitively, physically, emotionally? What are the things that I need to do to keep myself in a healthy zone so that I'm not wasting and draining energy on other things?
But easier said than done, because of the high margin pressure that we work in these days. Tough for companies to rethink culture if, as you're suggesting, pressure, interruption and overload are shaping everyday behavior more than, say, value statements. I would suggest to you that for many organizations that are so entrenched, it's going to be a very difficult thing to change that mindset, that operational methodology.
Yes, it is a challenge to change it, yet I would still purport that it's becoming, the rate of change is getting faster, especially as we're moving towards the AI generation. And without changing it, the gap is becoming larger. And the need for the role of people in the future is still going to be relevant, but it's going to be a higher value role of being able to make effective decisions. You need high quality judgment, high quality decisions, and you need to be in the right mindset energy-wise to be able to think clearly and freely. And the way we're going, that's not what's happening. Things are, we can have far too much information to process. It's going to eliminate and weaken the human role.
Ashwin Raja, thank you very much indeed. Fascinating conversation there, founder of the platform, the program Mindset Matters. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.